The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, yesterday we considered together the question of music and the arts in general, and the question of inspiration. And we tried to deal both with some problems in the culture that surrounds us, which impede inspiration, and then some of the positive steps that could be taken, and some of what the biblical perspective has to say about this. Today I'd like to go more deeply into the materials of music, and I would like to raise the question, why modern music? And under this question I'd like to raise another question, is there an avant-garde? And what I'd like to get at by way of conclusion is what attitude we should have towards the avant-garde, those involved in it, what attitude we should have towards our involvement with it, with the materials that avant-garde musicians have been dealing with, and what practical steps we can take if we're going to try to direct our attention to the problems of Christian art and Christian music in specific. I have discovered that as a musician, I've gained a certain amount of credibility both in the non-Christian world and in the Christian world, simply because of the fact that I'm a musician and don't come directly out of a, let's say, preaching or ministry tradition. And this is an interesting phenomenon that all I'm saying is that people will often listen to you if you're an artist, probably for the wrong reasons, but it's good to have the audience anyway. And you've gained a certain credibility, and in this situation, you can make certain statements that are even difficult for theologians to make, certain statements about orthodoxy. And yet, the temptation would be, as Christians in the arts, to take this as a kind of license to be weak and to be superficial in the arts in which we work, and only use them for a platform to say something into the theological world. I think this would be a mistake. There is a very close relationship between what's happening in music and in the culture at large. And I think it's very important for us, in order to understand our culture, to be able to see it in a specific way. And so what I'd like to do this morning is go into some very specific aspects of modern music, and to keep the first part of this study rather an empirical study, so that we really feel we're honestly grappling with some of the principles involved, and we're not simply making statements, shooting from the hip, making generalizations which may not in a particular situation apply. So I'd like to raise the question, is there an avant-garde in music? What is the avant-garde? Well, the dictionary definition of the avant-garde is the group or the first division of an army which is in battle array. And the image, of course, is a familiar one. It's of the army marching on and needing a guard in front of it to do the protecting. Now, this is not the same as the scout. This is a part of the army proper. And it implies a movement. It implies a direction. It implies that there is a certain direction in music, and it also implies that there are some that are at the head of this movement, some that are forging ahead and discovering new territory and that are bringing music into the place where it properly belongs. And we want to see if there's any meaning to this term, and then we can perhaps go into the question of what is happening. Now, I'd like to begin by playing a segment from a piece called Zeitmasse, which was written by a man named Karl-Heinz Stockhausen, who was born in 1928. This piece was written in 1956, and it's called Number 5 Zeitmasse for 5 Woodwinds. All right, now, as the name of this piece implies, it's a study of time. It's a study of units in time. It's written for 5 instruments: flute, oboe, English horn, bassoon, and clarinet. These are all woodwinds. And the directions for performing this piece of music are as follows. 5 time measures. The first is 12 tempi, that is the plural of tempo, the duration, 12 tempi between metronome 60 and metronome 120. Now, that simply means at a certain metronome rate, the metronome ticks at a certain rate per minute. And so 60 would be exactly one tick per second, and then 120 would be twice that. So the first tempo, the first time measure, is 12 tempi between metronome 60 and 120. The second, as fast as possible. The third, begin fast and slow down to 1/4 speed. The fourth, begin at 1/4 speed, accelerate to as fast as possible. And the fifth, as slow as possible. Now, the idea here, this may sound very strange to you, but the idea is that there are two extremes involved. There's the extreme of as fast as possible, and there's the extreme as slow as possible, which one of the instruments is playing at a given time. Actually, the piece is divided into 33 different segments. And in these 33 different segments, the instrumentalists trade roles. They don't all play the same tempo directions throughout. They trade roles, and there's a certain system in this. But the idea, basic idea here is that there are two extremes, not only in duration, as fast as possible, as slow as possible, but in timbre, the tone quality involved in the instruments themselves, the extremes of the flute and the bassoon, and the various other extremes that are involved. And the important principle to grasp here is what Stockhausen calls the principle of mediation. What Stockhausen is trying to do is to destroy the feeling of extremes. Now, this destruction of the feeling for extremes is called in modern music serial thought. Serial technique is a misnomer. It's too concrete. Really, what's involved is serial thought. That's his own term. And what he means by this is that serial thought is a principle that goes beyond music into all the arts and into all of our experience of life. So if any of you were at Jonathan Bragdon's talk yesterday, you'll see some of the same principles he was discussing in the arts applying here to this kind of music. Now, to explain this principle of mediation, let's take an example. We have two colors, white and black. Now, these are, in classical terms, extreme contrasts. They're absolute contrasts. And the idea of serial thought is to mitigate these two, to mediate them by degrees of difference between black and white, degrees of gray. There'll be some grays which will be heavier and darker, some grays which will be lighter. And so if you had, let's say, 60 shades in between black and white, you'd have all of the extremes represented. And then what happens is that the black and the white are not really extremes anymore. They're simply variations on the whole spectrum of gray. And what he's trying to do with this, in musical terms, is do the very same thing. You take tone qualities, which are seemingly extremes, or at least antithetical, and you mitigate between them by displaying all the tone qualities in between in such a way that the the absolute boundaries between the extremes really doesn't exist. The extremes are only part of the whole, if you see what I mean. By this means, anything that is seemingly insusceptible to mediation in life, in nature, or in art, or wherever else, may be mediated. You can take any element from nature and mediate it. And of course, what we have here is a philosophical challenge to classical dualism. And this philosophical challenge really brings us into a pantheistic situation. And so one of the important directions that modern music is taking really is closely allied to pantheism. And though in the West we don't have the same pantheistic tradition, we have a rationalistic tradition. The curious irony is that our rationalism, which gave birth to technology, is now being turned and being used for this principle of mediation, which brings us back to pantheism. And the way it can happen is that because of what rationalism is able to do, because of what statistical analysis is able to do, you can play with the statistics, and you can play so much that you can reduce any extreme and to be mediated by any degree of mediation, and so you've lost your antithesis. What's really being lost is contrast, classical dualism. Now, let's contrast this in music, just for a minute, to in a very well-known piece, Mozart's 40th Symphony, the first bars. Where's my sound? Is there a way that can be made a little louder? It was just right at the beginning of this thing. All right, those are the opening bars of Mozart's 40th Symphony. And what you have here in the structure of his thought, which is in the structure of the music, you have certain musical elements which belong side by side. Sometimes in discussing these and analyzing these, we use terms related to language. For example, there's a motive, there's a phrase, there's a period, and there's a contrast between two periods. So the little motive, that's the first sort of musical ingredient. And then it's contrasted by a second kind of motive. And then you have a phrase. The whole first part forms a phrase. And then that phrase is contrasted to a second phrase. And in classical music, music of the 18th century, this was one of the basic ingredients of melodic structure, was this balance between phrases. So that just as in a classical building, where there's a balance between both sides, you have the same principle in the music. You have one phrase, and then it's balanced off by a second phrase to make a period. The first phrase is called the antecedent phrase, and the second is called the consequent phrase. And then usually, to mark off the difference between these elements, you have cadences, ending points. Just as when we speak, we pause in order that the next thought might be communicated. And that's a cadence point in my speech. First motive in the first phrase. Moving on to the second phrase. Now, contrasting material. All right. Now, this kind of structure was put to many uses in the 18th century. One of the things that is involved here is a contrast between the vertical and the horizontal material. The vertical material being the harmony, the way the tones are put together, and the horizontal material being the phrase structure over a period of time. And what Mozart was doing here is something that every classical musician did. He did it best. But it's a tool that was available for any classical musician. And that is to use the harmony to give you a certain sense of direction and to use the tempo, the duration of this thing to give you a sense of direction. So that together they gave you a sense of the whole. There's a kind of a structure involved. Now the harmony and the rhythm are used to different effects. For example, at the end of this phrase, he goes on into another phrase and brings you into a new key area. He's been in G minor, and he brings you over to the area of B flat major, which is the relative major. And it gives you a slightly different feeling, as functional harmony does. You see, in 18th century thought, each kind of harmony gives a different feeling. The minor, the sort of somber minor key gives a certain kind of feeling, and then there's a kind of relief into the major area. And even more than this, there are other kinds of functions which chords had in those days, and the musicians were very well aware of them, and it was the greatest artist who could use these functions in relation to each other in order to bring out this kind of architectural feeling and the feeling of music which we all enjoy. Now, I'll give you an example of this. Now, he's done something a little different there. Same rhythm. Now he's in B-flat. He's got contrasting material in that key. And what he's done, he's used the same tempo and the same durational devices in time, but he's built different harmonies into them so that by the time you've been brought along by the duration into a new area, almost without realizing it, the harmony has changed your whole conception of the piece. Now, why am I going into this? It's in order to contrast two philosophies of music. The philosophy of music in this Mozart piece is one which is very much related to linguistics. And linguistics have certain absolutes involved in them. Leonard Bernstein, in his Norton lectures at Harvard, went into this in quite some detail. He tried to show how there are various parallels between language and music. And for example, he said, we could say that the motive is like a noun, and the harmony is like an adjective coloring the noun or qualifying the noun. And the rhythm or the meter is like a verb which gives a certain kind of sense of traveling to the whole thing. And you have absolute contrast between the functions of these things, although they work well together in harmony with one another. But you don't identify them. The rhythm is not the same as the vertical content. The vertical content is not the same as the melodic content, and so forth. There are different aspects to this, but in a linguistic sense, they all work together in a flow to communicate music, just as speech works together in a flow to communicate what's in our minds, what's in our hearts. Now, this is in a very different kind of philosophy from Stockhausen. In Stockhausen, we have the principle of mediation. And that is a principle which involves trying to destroy the boundaries between these various elements, trying to mediate between these extremes, and no longer keeping the horizontal and the vertical structures separate. And this is called by him also the principle of equal participation. So you have the principle of mediation, and closely related to it, the principle of equal participation. And so what you have here in Stockhausen is a kind of leveling out of many of the elements of music so that they all become equal. And instead of talking about music, which he doesn't, he talks about sound, because he goes into the most basic, reduced version of the musical experience, which is sound. And if you divide sound up into its basic qualities, you can get five elements in sound. The duration, which is its sound over a period of time. The pitch, which is sound involved in frequency level, high or low pitch. The dynamics, loud and soft. The timbre, which is the color, the quality of the sound. For example, the difference between, let's say, the organ here and a piano, a different timbre, although they may play the same note. 440, the note C may sound differently, played by different instruments. That's called timbre. And then fifthly, the position in space. If I'm speaking to you here, and then I walk over and speak to you from that side of the room, I have different. The sound comes to you from a different position in space. He calls this the platform. Now, interestingly enough, in most classical music, there's different emphases on these five elements of music. For example, in the Mozart, the timbre and the dynamics and the platform are much less important than pitch and duration. Okay? What the piece you heard, there wasn't a lot of contrast in dynamics. Yes, it goes up to a double forte from a single forte, but there's not much play with the dynamics during the whole piece. And the timbre may change from a woodwind section to a string section, but those are your basic ingredients throughout the whole symphony. You're not going to get a lot of exploration with timbre. But you are going to get a tremendous amount of exploration with harmony and duration. If you want the statistics on this, I don't know how they ever got this, but it seems that in classical music, there are 90 different possibilities for pitches, 40 different possibilities for duration. This is noting the music. 20 unmixed timbres at one pitch. 6 to 7 varieties of dynamics. That's going from triple piano to triple forte with a mezzo forte in the middle, piano forte in the middle. And then one platform. So that you can see the emphasis is on pitch and duration. Now, what Stockhausen is trying to do is to try to find a medium or a music, a way of expressing this, where all of these elements can be equalized, can be given equal participation. Okay? And what medium do you suppose best enabled him to get this across? Well, of course, it's electronic music. Because music that can be synthesized, or sound that can be synthesized and can be produced by a sound generator, has infinitely more capabilities for variety and for contrast than music that's given to you by a classical orchestra. So he got himself involved in electronic music, and in fact he wrote the first totally electronic music piece in 1953 in Cologne, in the very famous gallery, the studio there, the electronic music studio in Cologne. And so he is very much the father of modern electronic music. Now, electronic music of various kinds has been going on for a long time. The French, back in the 30s and earlier with Edgar Varèse, have been using a certain kind of electronic music which takes the sounds of nature and turns them around, twists them around, translates them into an electronic medium and plays them. But Stockhausen is the first who really had a purely electronic medium for the reasons that I've outlined. He was seeking a way to give equal time and to all of these elements, and in a way that doesn't give preeminence to a certain structure dependent on the rhythm or dependent on the harmony, the way we've seen in the Mozart piece. And this is one of the things he's come up with. 1964, Microphony 1. Wrong button. Now, this piece, I'm sorry it wasn't louder. There's an awful lot involved in there. I don't know what's gone wrong with our system. I guess after my talk yesterday, it doesn't really matter. This is a piece, it's called Microphony 1, 1964, and it's scored for a tam-tam, two microphones, two filters, and potentiometers. And the idea is, yeah, it is, I guess it's funny. I don't know, I've been involved in this so much that I can't laugh anymore, but he went into his garden one day and hung a tam-tam and then activated this tam-tam by household objects, anything that he found around the house. And then he would pick up the sounds that were made on two microphones that were very directional, that only took the sound from one direction. And he rotated the direction of these microphones rather at random. And then he had somebody playing on the musical equipment, the studio equipment, in order to give all kinds of contrast within the filters and all the other things that an electronic instrument can give you. So that what's happening here is that all of the elements of the music receive equal attention, And the artist is really, his role is to try and sit back passively and allow these elements to have equal time. There's an element of improvisation here, because the person who's sitting doing the dials, in a way, is the creator and the improviser. But he's not doing it in order to get himself across. He's not trying to say something that's on his heart. He's simply trying to bring out sounds and qualities that are involved in the experience of the tam-tam being activated itself. And the point is here, this is the principle of equal participation is brought out as much as you possibly could, because here there's no, as it were, prejudice for classical form. There's no prejudice towards an emphasis on duration or an emphasis on functional harmony. It's a way of trying, it's a negative principle. It's a way of destroying prejudice for or against one of the five musical elements. And as I said, these principles, these two principles, the principle of equal, the principle of mediation and the principle of equal participation, are really the result of a certain philosophy of aesthetics, which is part of a more general philosophy of life. And if you have studied modern culture, you can see that many of the same things are going on today in lots of different fields. In physics, nuclear physics, the emphasis is on reductionism. Can we reduce matter to its lowest possible irreducible ingredient? We have to go beyond the atom into subatomic particles, beyond subatomic particles into the infinitely small levels of energy and size and so forth. And it's the same not only in the specific area of reductionism, but in physics, where you're trying to balance off the four elements of time and space and mass and energy. This is apparently what Einstein was doing towards the end of his life, trying to find a kind of unified field where he had worked out this space-time continuum in his famous formula, and he had worked out this the relation between energy and mass in an abstract way, and he was trying to put the four together, and apparently he couldn't succeed, but the generation that came after him is still working on this problem. And so you have the same kind of thing that's involved in an area of science, a reductionism, a giving of equal time, a trying to find the lowest irreducible element, and then seeing if you can hold them together somehow into a formula. And of course, if you can do this, if you can hold together all of these elements in reality, you've got in the palm of your hand, you've got the key to the universe. The real artist is the scientist who can do this, because he's the one who can control the whole thing. And you have the same thing in modern art, this melting down principle that Jonathan talked about yesterday, where all of the elements in the environment are included in your artistic experience. There's no difference between what is art and what is not art. There's no difference between what's on the stage and what's off the stage. And beyond that, there's no difference between one kind of artistic experience and another. There's no climax to the play. Every element in the play is just as important as every other element. And it kind of leaves you with this feeling of the whole. You have the same thing in film. For example, Andy Warhol, who did this film of the Empire State Building. It's a 7-hour and 50-minute film of the Empire State Building. It doesn't move. You just have to watch the Empire State Building for 8 hours. And what's he trying to do? He's not just playing with you. He's trying to show this type of thing. Why should any one element of reality receive any more attention than any other element of reality? And you have the same thing in behavioral science. There's been an identity sought between man and nature, between inorganic and organic life, and between man and woman, and so forth. And there's no distinctions that are made. Rather, there's this whole. And the whole consists of all of the parts in a kind of a mosaic pattern floating around. And you're floating around in it. And what's inside your head, which is a modern term for that very reason, is only limited by your skull from participating in the outside. And the work of the artist is to take what's inside of your head and to make it participate with what's going on outside of it, so that you too flow into the universe as a whole. You're like the drop in the proverbial bucket, but this time the drop is put in the bucket and it loses its identity by flowing into the whole. Now this kind of music, which I've been discussing, didn't just come by chance. It isn't here just because it happens to be the way that musicians turned in the 1950s. It's here because of a long series of historical phenomena which have moved along. And I'm not going to give you a complete picture of this. That would be a whole other lecture. But I'll give you some of the background for it historically, and then maybe it would be a good thing for individual study. Now, as we look at the history of this and why it came about, it's important that we remember that though we're trying to talk about an avant-garde, and though we're visualizing an army which is moving forward, in a way that's a false picture, because there really hasn't been an army moving forward. There's been many trends and counter-trends. People have resisted the avant-garde. People have done very different things. Some of them have been recognized, some of them have not. And there's a whole world of different expression today, and some of them are involved in the avant-garde and some of them are not.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over at this point.
At the same time, there does seem to be a general momentum that has built up towards more of an extreme. So if we go back to the 19th century, we could see some of these things beginning to happen. Of course, a lot of it has its roots in the 18th century, the rejection of some of the absolute principles that you see in Baroque music, the theory of the affects and so forth. And then from this, swinging around the other way in the 19th century, turning against the rationalism of the 18th century, and seeking a kind of romanticism, not in the sense we usually think of romanticism, an emphasis on feelings and back to nature and so forth, but within that, real romanticism is a seeking of a goal of in another world, seeking unity in a universe that is beyond. And so we come to the work of Wagner. And later this morning, we'll have a lecture specifically on Wagner and 19th century romanticism by Cook Kimball. So I'm not going to go into him in any detail. But let me play for you the beginning of Tristan und Isolde, one of his great operas. And I'll tell you before you hear this that it was one of the most controversial first five or six measures in the history of music. There's a scratch on the record, so please pardon the little clicks that come in. Now, those two gestures are characterized in the following way. No one note predicts where the next note is going to go. No one harmony, you can't hear any one harmony and safely assume what's going to follow, because he's constructed it in a way that each of the harmonies is so ambiguous that it could resolve itself in about 10 different ways. And this was something that, it was a bit of a shock in the musical world of the day. These ambiguities run out through the whole introduction. And so with Wagner, harmony becomes more and more ambiguous, more and more of a feeling of lack of structure, lack of direction. And what's happening, this whole musical drama is something that you could have a whole lecture on in itself. This whole musical drama is a love story between a man and a woman who, at the end, have a kind of experience of apotheosis. There's a sort of a melting in between themselves and the universe in a scene with fire and death and all kinds of transcendent implications. And the music, of course, supports this direction and pushes you to this kind of universe beyond. And you have the first steps that are taken towards this kind of serial thinking, because you begin to lose the functional security in your harmony. And then you have on the other side, in his thinking on the arts, Wagner tried to see a unification between all the arts. He didn't see why one art, music, should be kept separate from another art, drama. So he came up with his Gesamtkunstwerk, and this theory that all of the arts should be unified. And when you go to, if you were going this summer to Bayreuth, to the great centennial of the Wagner operas, you'll see this kind of almost worshipful mood among the audience, which is to be involved in this work. And the musical dramas are long and involved and all-encompassing. And this is kind of the beginning of this feeling of pantheism. And then in another way, Debussy was doing the same thing in a very different medium, in a very different kind of way, in his French way. Debussy is credited by many modern musicians with being the father of modern music. It's always hard to say exactly who is the father of anything, but a lot of modern avant-garde composers credit Debussy with being their ancestor, and you'll see why. This is a piano prelude called Voile, Sails, and you'll see that there's a kind of eerie quality here, and the eerie quality is achieved by taking the notes of the keyboard and removing functional harmony from them, but using the notes in the keyboard not in a harmonic sense, the tonic leads to the dominant and the dominant leads back to the tonic, but using them in a kind of a cell unit where there's certain types of motions and patterns within each cell unit, and then you move on to the next cell unit and there's more motion and pattern. And the scale that is used, instead of the diatonic scale, which is the scale we Westerners are most familiar with, and the scale that seems most available for functional harmonists, is the whole tone scale, which puts an exactly equal relationship between all the notes, a whole step between all the notes, instead of what the diatonic scale is, which is whole, whole, half, whole, 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 half. All right, so you see you're beginning to have the same type of emphasis in a very specific harmonic way. Bernstein's sense of language is dying here. The harmonies are not being used as adjectives, the motives are not being used as nouns, and the rhythm is not being used to drive it forward. But you're getting a feeling of mosaics, these cell units working within each other. And Debussy was very much aware of this, and he was a revolutionary in his time. And he was one of the supporters of a lot of the new music that was going on, and a lot of the new poetry, and a lot of the new art. And so you can see what's beginning to happen. The phrases and the periods have disappeared. You don't have really a sense of phrase and period. You have a sense of different musical experiences strung together in a row. And one of his greatest orchestral works, called La Mer, is the epitome of this kind of thing at an orchestral level. What does the sea do, according to Debussy? Debussy sees the ocean as a series of waves that go up and down and up and down, and they're each different, but they're each part of the ocean. And his music is the same thing. Each of the cells goes up and down, moves around, and then never repeats itself quite in the same way. Yet it's all part of the same piece of music, the same kind of universe that he's created for you. Now, moving on and back into the Germanic area, to me, the most important figure in changing the materials of 20th century music is a man named Anton Webern. And Anton Webern, in a very different way from Schoenberg, discovered the 12-tone principle of writing music. And this 12-tone principle is a principle which tries to get away from the preeminence of any single note, as you would have it in the diatonic scale, by using the 12 different scales of the piano right in succession, and not repeating any one tone until the previous 12 have been fully explored. In other words, you can't give any preeminence to any one tone by repetition or by any other device. And to give you an idea of how he discovered this process, it was a long term. It wasn't something he didn't just sit down at his desk one day and say, I've got a new idea, I'm going to try it. But it was a sort of a process of discovery for him. And he relates about this. We're very fortunate in the case of Webern. He gave two lectures called The Path to the New Music, two lecture series, and back in the 30s, where he tried to explain his thinking process and his analysis of the army that was moving forward as he saw it. So he says this, and this is The Path to the New Music. What happened? I can only relate something from my own experience. About 1911... I wrote the Bagatelle for String Quartet, and I'm going to play that for you. All very short pieces, lasting a couple of minutes, perhaps the shortest in music so far. Here I had the feeling, when all the 12 notes have gone by, the piece is over. Much later, I discovered that all this was a part of the necessary development. In my sketchbook, I wrote out the chromatic scale and crossed off the individual notes. And we still have these sketchbooks, and we can see exactly what he did. Why? Because I had to convince myself this note has been there already. It sounds grotesque, incomprehensible, and it was incredibly difficult. The inner ear decided quite rightly that the man who wrote out the chromatic scale and crossed off individual notes was no fool. He quotes a man here. Then he says, in short, a rule of law emerged. Until all 12 notes have occurred, none of them may occur again. The most important thing is that each run of 12 notes marked a division within the piece, or an idea, or a theme. This is Opus 9. Of the piece. Now, why is it so short? Well, if you're only going to use each of the individual notes and not repeat them, then you've only got so much material to deal with. And the only principles that you could use to expand them would be to repeat the process again, which is what he did. And later, this was to be developed in much more detail. But you can see what he was struggling with here. And so he says that he feels this inner compulsion to move in this direction. He says, adherence to this rule is strict, often burdensome, but it's salvation. He uses that word. We couldn't do a thing about the dissolution of tonality. It just happened. And we didn't create the new law ourselves. It forced itself overwhelmingly on us. So he doesn't believe that he's creating something new. He believes he's discovering something that's in the universe that has to be brought out through the artist. This compulsion adherence is so powerful that one has to consider very carefully before finally committing oneself to it for a prolonged period, almost as if taking the decision to marry, a difficult moment. Trust your inspiration. There's no alternative. So it's a bit like breaking the sound barrier here. He hesitated, he went back, and then he went forward and went into it, and he had to trust his inspiration. And so he had this sense, here is what the avant-garde is. It's the army moving ahead. It's the first part of the army moving ahead into new areas. But these new areas are areas which are based on this whole philosophy of the melting down, the reducing of the elements of reality to the single irreducible element, and then putting it together again in a pattern of these elements which has no external structure to it. It's simply a mosaic. And what are we left with? Only a mosaic of sounds. And the search goes on. And the search for a deeper, irreducible element continues with Stockhausen. And you get, for example, the extremes that you have in the latest things that are going on in music today are minimal music, something parallel to the minimal art kind of situation. For example, one man will stand on the stage in a dark room with a comb and tissue paper in his mouth and will play one note on it, and that's the concert. And the idea is that there's nothing else except that single element that you're going to concentrate on. Or there's something called flexus, which is body music. And it's music that can only be created from the human body in various means. And this sounds absurd. And in a way it is absurd. But it's not absurd given the philosophical context in which these people are operating. And yet, in a way, the search is doomed. Because if you have a Christian understanding of the universe, there is no irreducible element to the creation itself. The creation only sends you back to God. That's the function of the creation. It reveals God. That's what Romans 1 is all about. So the deeper you go into creation in a context that is without God, all you're going to do is find things that are more and more detailed, but never go back to the whole. It's a bit like taking a beautiful vase and in order to find the irreducible essence of the vase, shattering it on the ground and picking up the individual pieces of glass and hoping that one of these might be the irreducible element. And then it isn't. So you shatter that piece and you take the little tiny splinters and you hope that one of them is going to be the irreducible element. But it isn't, and you keep going. The search, in a way, is doomed because there is no irreducible element to the universe. The universe, the created world, is a reflection of God. And without God who runs the universe, it doesn't make sense. You can't get an essence of the created world without the Creator. At the same time, this music is not entirely consistent for the reasons that I've said. Because God is the Creator, you can't find Him, you can't find a man who is creating music that doesn't in some way reflect that, despite himself. Even in the farthest out pieces of modern music, the human element creeps back in, and it reminds you of the fact that we're human and that God has made us. Even in the strangest piece by John Cage, you find little human moments which tell us that he is still a creature with his creaturely limitations, and he can't help but reflect the presence of God. And something interesting, and that is that the Bible sees man as doing just this, that he's moving in a certain direction away from God, and yet at the same time, in moving, he can't help but bear witness to God despite himself. And this seems to me the New Testament emphasis. And although I'm not specifically a theologian, theology has helped me a great deal to see this in modern music. Because a proper biblical theology shows me that man is on this desperate attempt to run away from God, but at the same time, he bears witness to God in his very running away. A professor who was at this seminary for a long time, after whom this hall was named, had this image of a little boy sitting on his father's lap and slapping his father in the face. And the absurdity of it is that the father could drop him from his lap anytime he wanted. The only way the child could slap his father in the face is if the father were supporting him in the first place. And this, I think, is what you have in modern music. The only way in which these musicians can deal with the sounds and make these discoveries at all is if there's some kind of structure that holds it all together to give them the incentive to go in and explore it. And yet they're going in the wrong direction. So you have this dynamic. Now, the Apostle Paul talked about that in Acts 17. Acts 17 is a really crucial text for apologetics, because here Paul is talking to the non-Christian. He's not addressing specifically the Jews. He's not addressing people who are in a Christian church that need revitalizing. He's addressing the Greek philosophers. And in Acts 17, verse 26, he says this, "And he, God, made from one every nation of men to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their habitation, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel after him and find him. Yet he is not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being, even as some of your poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring." Now what he's doing is something really profound. He's gone into this culture. He's seen the idolatry. He's seen the non-Christian philosophy. He's seen their lostness. But instead of charging them with this directly at the outset, he gets on their side in a funny way, and he says, you know this just as well as I do, because some of your own poets have said this. Now, to be sure, he quotes those poets out of context. If you took the whole context of being his offspring and living and moving and having our being in God, it would be a kind of a pantheism, similar to what we've been discussing this morning. But if you take it out of context, you can see that certain elements in their philosophy bear witness to the fact that they really know who their creator is in the first place. And God has put them on the earth in order to seek their creator, if haply they might find him. And that's what we're all doing. That's what the non-Christian artist is doing. He's seeking after God, if haply he might find him. That doesn't mean he is in the right direction seeking after God, but it is a search for God. And if we understand that, it gives us a position to be able to be of great value to this person and to ourselves if we're involved in these things. Romans 1 says the same thing. Knowing God, they exchange him, but they know him, but they exchange him. This dynamic is the tension that's alive in every artist in the non-Christian world. And it's the tension that's alive even in these far-out avant-garde spheres. There is an avant-garde. There is an avant-garde today. It's the army that's marching ahead in this search that Webern described in his emotional way. But in a way, it's an aimless search. It's a search to find the irreducible essence of reality in creation. But the irreducible essence of reality isn't in creation. It's back with the Creator. Only in having the Creator do we understand the creation. The beginning of Calvin's Institutes, this work of genius and of Christian inspiration, saw this perfectly. Calvin said, in effect, you can't understand man without understanding God, and you can't understand God without understanding man. If you want to know God, you have to know man. If you want to know man, you have to know God. There's no real place to begin. You don't sort of abstractly begin up here and then work down towards man. You end up with neo-orthodoxy. And you don't abstractly begin with man and build up towards God. You end up with rationalism. You begin both places at once. This is the Christian epistemology. And this is what the Christian artist and the Christian musician is wrestling with. You don't abstractly begin with the elements of music because it's going to drive you to this wrong concern for pure sound and equalization and mediation. Nor do you begin abstractly from some spiritual principle and then organize the music in an irresponsible way, because then you end up with a kind of superficial music that doesn't really deal with the elements of music. You begin both places at once. And so the avant-garde is there. But we can have compassion on people who are involved in it because we understand the struggles that they're struggling with. And we struggle with them before we became Christians, and we struggle with similar things as Christians, although from a different sphere. So we can have compassion on them, and furthermore, we can benefit from some of the work that they have done. Because in the march forward, though there's been a lot of destruction, and though there's been a pantheism and a kind of mosaicizing of art, which is not helpful, there has nevertheless along the way been discoveries. There have been discoveries which can be very useful to us. In fact, which put us in the 20th century. A lot of the elements of modern music and modern art can, in a reorganized way, serve the Christian. And if you were at the concert yesterday afternoon, you can hear the beginnings of what some of the possibilities are. This group, Elan, did a wonderful job with this. They were taking elements from what you might call the pop music avant-garde, but they were Christianizing them by putting them into a new context and using them in a different way. And they are aware, as anybody else, that they haven't done this perfectly and that there's a long way to go. But it's a beginning, and it's rather exciting. And so as we look at this picture, we as Christian artists can have these two attitudes. One, we have to be warned about the frightening direction that this thing is taking. But secondly, we can be understanding of how to use some of the elements that they have discovered for our own art. And this is true of the whole thinking in the Bible. This is the way the Bible tells us to be involved in the world, not of the world. We're not to go and be out of the world so that we separate ourselves so completely from what's going on the outside, and we form a little club or a monastery of our own, and we build ourselves up spiritually, but we're of no use. The salt loses its saltiness when that happens. Nor are we to become so identified with the world that we lose our roots. And this tension, this dynamic that we experience, is the dynamic that brings us towards progress, and that will one day, it is my prayer, bring us towards a better kind of Christian art. And so the biblical pattern that we are to follow, as it fits right into to the picture of the latest thing in modern music, makes the gospel totally relevant. Or maybe it makes us relevant to the gospel. Because the gospel is the good news that Christ has become man in order to deal with man's problems, where man is. And where is man today? Man is in the avant-garde. Man is in the nostalgia cults. Man is in the middle class. Man is in the security people. Man is in every element of 20th century culture. And if Christ was incarnated in the 20th century, he would have come to deal with these very people. And so we as Christians can go out and deal with these very things without feeling we're going to be dirtied. And if we do get dirtied, we can go back to the cross, ask forgiveness, come back again and try again. We're not only out there to save souls, we're out there to redeem the universe, to redeem the cosmos, which is what's going to happen at the end of time. And if we have this total attitude about what Christianity is, all of a sudden it's not a burden anymore. Maybe some of you have grown up in Christian situations where Christianity has been a burden, a weight on the back, kind of like the Pilgrim's Progress, where a Christian has this great weight on his back. And maybe a lot of legal doctrinal jargon has been handed to you, and you've interpreted this as a kind of a great burden and a great slavery. But if you look at what's going on, you can see that those very doctrines and that very biblical thinking that you grew up to reject because of the way it was handed to you is the only hope we have in order to deal with our modern situation. And as Christian artists, as Christian musicians, it's the only hope we have if we're going to deal with the situation today and if we're going to produce something that really has something to say. And this is how to really preach the gospel. And this is how it applies in our lives. So Christianity is something that's tremendously relevant, to use an old-fashioned word. And the world today is tremendously relevant to Christianity. And this is something I want to be involved with, and this is something we all want to be involved with together. And it's really the most exciting thing in the world. This is the highest privilege, the highest calling we could be called to. And it's something not to be ashamed of. It's something to really be involved with. We don't have to be ashamed of the gospel. And so let's work together during the remaining part of this conference to think of ourselves in this context as God's people who are out to try and understand what's going on and to try and live between these tensions and yet come out of it as people who are really in fellowship with him. Because the final goal of our work indeed is not to come up with a Christian art that is valid, but is to have fellowship with this God. This is our highest calling. And there could be no greater fulfillment, no greater irreducible experience than fellowship with our Creator through Jesus Christ. And this is our goal. This ought to be our goal together, even as we work in the arts, so that they don't become our God, but the giver of the arts is our God.